46. The Castle of the Holy Grail. For half the day a dull cloud hung low over Moscow, and it was not cold. But when the seven prisoners stepped out of the blue bus into the exercise yard, just in time for dinner, the first impatient snowflakes were making their lonely flight. One of them, a regular hexagonal mini-star, fell on the sleeve of Nyerzhin's rusty old army coat. He stood still in the middle of the yard, gulping fresh air. Senior Lieutenant Schusterman happened to be there, and warned him that since this was not an exercise period, he had better go indoors. Nyerzhin was put out. He did not wish to, he simply could not, talk about his wife's visit. Didn't want to confide in anybody or seek anybody's sympathy. Did not want to talk at all, or to listen. All that he wanted was to be alone and to return through his mind all the impressions he had brought back with him, before they blurred and became mere memories. But solitude is the last thing you are likely to find in a Sharashka or any other prison camp. Everywhere you went, in the cells, the convicts' compartments, and cattle trucks on trains, huts in the camps, hospital wards, there are always people, people, people. People you knew and people you didn't want to know, thin people, fat people, but always people and more people. On his way into the building, by the special entrance for prisoners, down wooden steps and along the basement hallway, Nyerzhin paused to think where he should go next. He had an idea. He took the back stairs, which hardly anybody used, and went up past the broken chairs stacked there to the top landing on the third floor. The landing had been converted to a studio for a prisoner named Kondrashov Ivanov. He had no connection with the general work of the Sharashka, and was kept on as a sort of serf artist. The vestibules and halls of the main building were spacious and needed pictorial adornment. Less spacious, but more numerous, were the private apartments of Deputy Minister Fomo Gurjanovich and his close colleagues, and these were still more urgently in need of large, beautiful, cost-free pictures. Not that Kondrashov Ivanov really satisfied these requirements. The pictures he painted were big, all right, and cost nothing, but beautiful they were not. The colonels and generals who came to view his gallery wasted their breath dinning into him how he ought to paint and what colours he should use, then accepted with a sigh what was on offer. Besides, his pictures improved greatly when mounted in gilt frames. On his way up, Nyerzhin passed a large canvas commissioned for the vestibule of the main building. A.S. Popov demonstrates the first radio telegraph to Admiral Makarov. As he turned onto the last flight, and before he saw the artist, he caught sight of a painting high up on a blank wall, The Blasted Oak, a finished picture 2 meters high, which, for some reason, none of the artist's patrons had wanted. Other canvases hung along the walls of the stairwell. There were some on easels. The light came from 2 windows, one on the north, the other on the west side. The Iron Mask's little window, with its grating and its little pink curtain, looked out on the landing itself, which was as near as it got to the light of day. There was nothing else to be seen, not even a chair. Instead, there were 2 logs standing on end, one higher than the other. The stairway was inadequately heated. The studio was always damp and cold, but Kondrashov Ivanov's sleeveless jacket lay on the floor, and he himself stood motionless, tall and erect, with his arms and his legs sticking out of his skimpy overalls, not, apparently, freezing. The big glasses, which made his face large and stern, were pressed firmly down over his ears to allow for his abrupt twists and turns at a picture, brush in one hand, palette in the other, held at arm's length. He looked around when he heard cautious steps. Their eyes met, but their minds were still elsewhere. The artist was not altogether pleased to see a visitor. Just now he needed solitude and silence. Yet he was more pleased than not, and there was no falsity in his hearty welcome. "Gleb Vikentich, welcome!" Hospitable hands flourished brush and palette. Good nature is a dubious asset for an artist. It enriches his imagination, but wrecks his routine. Nyerzhin hesitated in embarrassment on the next to last step. He spoke almost in a whisper, as though there were some third person whom he feared to awaken. "No, please, Ippolit Mikhailich, I've only come... I hope you don't mind. I wanted to be quiet for a bit." "Yes, yes, of course." The artist nodded and said no more, perhaps remembering or reading in his eyes that Nyozhin had been to see a visitor. He retreated with a sort of bow, pointing with brush and palette to one of the stumps. Nyozhin gathered up his coattails, which he had saved from shortening in the camp, and sank onto the stump, leaning back against the banisters. As much as he wanted to, he did not light a cigarette. The artist's gaze was fixed again on the same spot in his picture. They were silent. Reawakened affection for his wife was a faint, pleasurable ache in Nyozhin's breast. He felt as though his fingers, where they had touched her hands, her neck, her hair in farewell, were dusted with some precious pollen. Year after year, you live deprived of what should be every man's right on this earth. You are left with your mind, if any, your beliefs, if you are mature enough to have acquired any, and you are chock-full of concern for the general good. You might be a citizen of ancient Athens, a complete human being. Only, the one thing needful is missing. That one thing, the love of a woman, of which you are deprived, seems more momentous than all the world besides. Those simple words. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Unspoken except in looks or soundless movements of the lips, now fill your heart with quiet rejoicing. At that moment, Gleb could not remember or imagine any fault in his wife. She had all the virtues, and above all, loyalty. A pity he had hesitated to kiss her at the beginning of the visit. Now that kiss was lost beyond recall. Her lips were slack. She had forgotten how to kiss. She looked exhausted, like a hunted creature. How desperate she must be to talk of divorce. A legal divorce? Gleb had no objection. Tearing up a piece of officially stamped paper would mean nothing to him. The union of souls was no concern of the state. Nor, for that matter, was the union of bodies. But he had been bruised and battered enough by life to know that events have their own inexorable logic. People never dream what the perverse consequences of their routine actions may be. Take Popov. When he invented radio, did he realize that he was letting loose pandemonium, inflicting torture by loudspeaker on solitary thinkers? Or take the Germans, who let Lenin through to bring down Russia and 30 years later found their own country split in two. Or take Alaska. They had been stupid enough to sell it for a song, and now Soviet tanks could not reach America overland. Such trivialities could determine the fate of the planet. Or take Nadia. She wanted a divorce to escape from persecution. But once divorced, she would be married again before she knew it. His heart had sunk when her ringless fingers had waved goodbye to him. That was how people said goodbye forever. Nyozhin sat there in silence, and the excessive joy he had felt after the visit, the joy that had filled him to overflowing in the bus, gradually ebbed, banished by sober and gloomy thoughts. But this restored his mental equilibrium, and he was soon Nyozhin the old Zek again. "It suits you here," she had said. Prison suited him. It was true. He did not really regret the 5 years he had spent inside. Even now, before he could see them in perspective, Nyozhin recognized that they were a uniquely necessary part of his life. Where could you get a better view of the Russian Revolution than through the bars it had set in place? What better place to get to know people? And yourself. Only the iron-hard path ordained for him could have spared him so many false steps, so much youthful vacillation. This dreamer, Kondrashov Ivanov, so impervious to the cruel jokes of the age, what had he lost by being imprisoned? He could not, of course, wander about the Moscow countryside with his paint-box. He had no table for still lifes. Exhibitions? He had never known how to arrange one for himself, and in half a century had never shown a single picture in a reputable gallery. Money for his pictures? He had never been paid, even outside. Appreciative viewers? He probably attracted more of them here. A studio? Outside, he hadn't had anything as good as this. A single, long, narrow room, like a hallway, had served him as studio and living quarters. To make room to work, he had to stack chair upon chair and roll up the mattress, so that callers asked whether he was moving. They had had only one table, so when a still life was set upon it, he and his wife ate off chairs until the picture was finished. During the war there had been no oil for paints, and he had mixed his colours with rationed sunflower oil. He had to earn his ration cards, and they sent him to a chemical warfare division to paint portraits of women soldiers who obtained the best grades on military and political courses. 10 portraits were commissioned, but he chose just one of the 10 best girls and wore her out with long sittings. Even so, his version of her was not at all what the top brass wanted to see, and Moscow 1941, as the picture was called, found no takers. Yet the essence of 1941 was in that portrait. A girl in an anti-gas suit. Her head was thrown back, and she stared wildly at something hideous, something unforgivable before her. But this was no weak, girlish figure. Hands trained for battle gripped the sling of her gas mask. The dark grey anti-gas suit, with its stiff creases and silvery glint where the light caught its folds, looked like a suit of armour. Nobility, cruelty, and vengefulness had come together and were engraved on the face of this determined Komsomol from Kaluga, this far-from-beautiful girl in whom Kondrashov Ivanov had seen a Joan of Arc. It was, you might think, very much in the spirit of the wartime slogan, "We shall not forget, we shall not forgive." But it went too far. It showed something savage, uncontrollable. It was rejected and never exhibited. It stood for years in the artist's little room, with its face to the wall, and went on standing there until he was arrested. Leonid Andreev's son, Daniil, had written a novel and asked a couple of dozen friends to hear it. A Thursday salon, 19th-century style. That novel cost every member of the audience 25 years in a corrective labour camp. One of those who heard the seditious work was Kondrashov Ivanov, great-grandson of the Decembrist Kondrashov, sentenced to 20 years for his part in the 1825 Rising, and remembered for the touching behaviour of a French governess who loved him and followed him to Siberia. True, Kondrashov Ivanov did not end up in a camp. As soon as he had signed the receipt for his sentence, he was taken to Marfino and put to work, painting a picture a month on Fomo Gurjanovich's orders. In the past 12 months, he had painted the pictures hanging there and others that had been removed. With 50 years behind him and 25 ahead, he had not lived but flitted effortlessly through that halcyon year, not knowing whether there would ever be such another. He did not notice what he was given to eat or to wear, or how often his head was counted among all those others. He was, of course, deprived of opportunities to meet and talk to other artists, or to look at their pictures, or to find out from albums of reproductions filtering through customs what direction painting was taking in the West. Wherever it was going, it could have no influence on, no relevance to, the work of Kondrashov Ivanov, because in the magic pentagram where all discoveries were made and all creation took place, all 5 angles were occupied once and for all, 2 by drawing and colour, as only he could see them, 2 by universal good and universal evil, and the 5th by the artist himself. He could not return on his own 2 legs to the landscapes he had once seen, or with his own hands reproduce the same still lifes. But he had begun to see them more clearly, and in their true colours, in cells half darkened by muzzles, and those he had never painted before, he could paint now from memory. One of these still lifes, based on the 4-by-5 ratio over the Egyptian square, Kondrashov attached very great importance to the proportions of the sides, was hanging right then next to Mamurin's window. Half of its surface was taken up by a brightly polished round copper tray standing up on edge. It was just an ordinary tray, but its effect was that of a hero's blazing shield. By it stood a jug of some dark metal, beaten and burnished, probably meant to hold water, not wine. And on the wall behind them was draped a piece of golden-yellow brocade. Kondrashov was particularly attracted by all shades of yellow just now, that could be seen as the mantle of the invisible. There was something in the combination of these 3 objects that inspired courage and forbade retreat. The colonels had all refused this still life, insisting that the tray should be laid down flat and a cut melon or something of the sort placed on it. Kondrashov worked on several pictures at once, leaving them and coming back to them from time to time. He had never brought a picture to the stage at which his craftsman's eye could judge it perfect. He did not know for sure that there was such a stage. He always abandoned a picture when he no longer saw anything special in it, when his eye was so used to it that the changes he might make seemed more trivial at every return, and he realized that he might be spoiling it rather than improving it. He turned it to the wall, covered it up. The picture was rejected, estranged from him. But when he surrendered it gratis to hang amid pomp and luxury, he looked at it with a fresh eye, and the pang of parting was mingled with delight. If nobody saw it again, he had still painted it. Nerzhin, all attention now, started inspecting Kondrashov's last picture. A wintry brook occupied the main place in it. It was almost impossible to tell which way the brook was flowing. In fact, it was hardly flowing at all. A film of ice was beginning to form on its surface. There were brownish tints in the shallows, reflected from fallen leaves covering the bottom. The first snow lay in patches on both banks, and the grass in between was brown and withered. Two willows grew by the brook, wraith-like and misty, wet from the powdery snow melting into them. But the most important part of the picture was the background, a dense rampart of olive-black firs, with a single helpless birch gleaming in the front rank. Its gentle yellow glow made the host of sentinel conifers, with their sharp pikes raised skyward, look denser and darker still. The sky was a motley scrabble, and the setting sun was muffled by ragged cloud, which it was too weak to pierce with a direct ray. The focal point of the picture was not this, either. It was the chill water of the standing brook. It had fullness and depth. It was leaden, yet translucent, and it looked very cold. It seemed to hold the balance between autumn and winter. This was the picture on which the painter was now intent. Artistic creation is subject to an inexorable law, which Kondrashov knew only too well. He had struggled against it, but had ended by helplessly submitting. This law said that nothing he had done before had any value, none of it counted, none of it reflected credit on him. Only the picture on which he was working then and there was the summation of a lifetime's experience, the zenith of his powers, the one and only touchstone of his talent. And he could see that it was not going to work. But none of his previous pictures had been going to work, until, briefly, it did. Now past despair was forgotten. This was the first time he had ever seemed to be learning to paint properly. And still it wasn't working. His whole life was a failure. He had never had any talent at all. That water, now, it looked liquid and cold and deep and still, but none of that meant anything if it did not convey the wisdom, the completeness, the serenity that Kondrashov could never find in his passionate self, but recognized and revered in nature. Did his water convey that sublime serenity, or didn't it? Miserably, hopelessly, he struggled to decide. Did it? Didn't it? You know, Ippolit Mikhailovich, you've more or less convinced me. These places of yours are Russia. Kondrashov Ivanov looked around sharply.
And not the Caucasus?
His spectacles sat as firmly on his nose as if they were welded to it. Though not the weightiest of his concerns, it had a certain importance. Many people were perplexed by Kondrashov's landscapes, finding them Caucasian rather than Russian. Perhaps because they were too majestic, too awesome. I feel sure such places can be found in Russia, Nerzhin said still more positively. He rose from the stump and made the round of the landing, inspecting morning of an unusual day and other landscapes. The artist nodded excitedly.
Of course, can be found and have been found. I could take you there if we didn't need an escort. The fact is that the public is under the spell of Levitan. We are used to seeing the Russian landscape through Levitan's eyes, not unpleasant in its humble way, but monotonous, featureless. But if there's nothing more to Russia, where did her self-burners come from? The mutinous Streltsy, Peter I, the Decembrists, the People's Will Party.
Uh-huh, Nerzhin said approvingly.
You're right there.
But all the same, Ippolit Mikhailovich, I don't understand your passion for hyperbole. That crippled oak, for instance. Why does it have to be on the brink of a precipice? I feel sure there's an abyss down below. Nothing less would satisfy you. And the sky isn't just stormy. It looks like a sky that has never known the sun. And all the hurricanes that ever blew anywhere in the last 200 years have passed this way, twisting the tree's branches and struggling to claw it loose from the cliff. You're a Shakespearean, of course. Anything evil must be inordinately evil. But that's ancient history. Statistically, very few people find themselves in such situations. There's no need to spell good and evil with capital letters. I can't listen to such stuff. The artist waved his long arms angrily. Evil is ancient history, you say? Evil never really put in an appearance before our century. In Shakespeare's time, what passed for evil-doing was sport for callow youths. We ought to spell good and evil, not just with capitals, but with letters 5 stories high, letters that flash like lighthouses. Let's not split hairs. Statistically few. What about you and me and the rest of us here? And how many millions are there like us?
Well, yes, Nyazin said, shaking his head doubtfully.
If we're in a camp and we're invited to sell whatever conscience we have left for 200 grams of black bread, but that has no resonance, so to speak. It somehow doesn't show.
Kondrashov Ivanov stood up still straighter, rose to his full, not inconsiderable height. He gazed at something higher still ahead of him, like Egmont led to execution.
Prison camp should never break a man's spirit.
Nyazin laughed wryly.
Shouldn't, perhaps. But it does. You haven't been in a camp yet, so you can't judge. You don't know how they crunch our fragile bones in the camps. It doesn't matter what you're like when you go in. You come out changed beyond recognition. As everybody knows, being determines consciousness.
No, no, no! Kondrashov Ivanov spread his long arms, ready then and there to wrestle with the whole world.
No, no, no! That would be too degrading. If that were true, life wouldn't be worthwhile. If it is so, tell me, why do lovers remain faithful to each other when they're parted? Being demands that they be unfaithful. And why do people in exactly the same circumstances, in the same camp even, behave so differently? Who can know for sure whether life moulds man, or the strong and noble being moulds life?
Nerzhin was quietly confident that his experience of life was worth more than the fantasies of this ageless idealist, but he could not help admiring his sentiments.
Every man is born with a sort of inner essence, Kondrashov said. It is, so to speak, the innermost core of the man, his essential self. No being, nothing extraneous, can determine him. Moreover, every man carries within himself an image of perfection, which is never dimmed, and which sometimes stands out with remarkable clarity, and reminds him of his chivalrous duty.
Nerzhin had by now returned to his seat on the log. He scratched the back of his head.
That's another thing, he said. Why do you go in for all these knights and their knightly trappings? You seem to me to go too far, though Mitya Sologdin, of course, likes it. Your anti-aircraft girl is a knight in armour. Your copper tray is a shield.
What?
Kondrashov was amazed.
You don't like it? I go too far, do I? Ha ha ha!
Operatic laughter echoed in the hollow stairwell like thunder in a mountain gorge. As though about to ride him down, he thrust out an arm toward Nerzhin, and his pointing finger was the head of his levelled lance.
Who was it who expelled the knights from our lives? Lovers of money and trade, lovers of orgies and feasting. What is it our age most lacks? Party members? No, sir, it lacks knights. In the days of chivalry there were no concentration camps, no gas chambers.
Suddenly he was silent. In a single movement, he alighted softly from his steed and sank into a squatting position beside his visitor. His glasses flashed as he asked in a whisper,
"Would you like me to show you something?"
Arguments with artists always end that way.
"Yes, of course."
Kondrashov, still stooping, shuffled off into a corner, pulled out a small canvas on a stretcher, and brought it over, keeping the grey, obverse side toward Nilgin.
"You know who Parsifal was?"
he asked in a low voice.
"Wasn't he connected with Lohengrin?" "His father, the guardian of the Holy Grail. I try to visualize that precise moment, the moment any man may experience when he first catches sight of the image of perfection."
Kondrashov closed his eyes and drew in his lips. He had to prepare himself, too. Nerzhin wondered why what he was about to see was so small. The artist raised his eyelids.
"It's only a sketch. A sketch for the most important picture in my life. I will probably never paint it. It's the moment when Parsifal first caught sight of the castle of the Holy Grail."
The picture was twice as high as it was wide. It showed a wedge-shaped crevice between two converging mountain precipices. On each of them, to the right and to the left, the trees on the fringe of a dense primeval forest edged into the picture. Creeping bracken and ugly shrubs clung to the very edges, and even the perpendicular walls of the two cliffs. High on the cliff to the left, a light grey horse had emerged from the forest, carrying a rider in a helmet and a scarlet cloak. The horse was not afraid of the abyss. Its hoof was raised ready in obedience to the rider's will, either to back away or to cross the abyss. It had the strength to leap as though winged. The rider himself had no eyes for the abyss before his horse. He was staring in rapt amazement into the depths of the picture, where an orange-gold radiance suffused the whole expanse of the sky above, emanating perhaps from the sun, perhaps from a still purer source concealed by the castle. Stepped and turreted, growing out of the stepped mountain and visible also from below through the cleft between the cliffs, between the trees and the ferns, rising to a needle point in mid-heaven at the top of the picture, hazy and indistinct, as if spun from shifting cloud, yet discernible in all the details of its unearthly perfection, ringed in a blue-grey aureole by the invisible super-sun, stood the castle of the Holy Grail.